This lecture, entitled Sfas, Safed and the Dawn of the Ottoman Empire, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Brin family. In previous lectures of this series, we traced the history of Eretz Yisrael, especially of Yerushalayim, from the days of its destructions at the hands of the Romans until the end of the 15th century. In the following century, Eretz Yisrael, especially the city of Tzfas or Safed, underwent a dramatic transformation to become one of the most vibrant Jewish communities in the world and one of the most famous in terms of its literary output. It was in 16th century Tzfas, Safed, that Rav Yosef Karo completed his Sefer Beis Yosef and wrote the Shulchan Aruch, some of the most frequently quoted works on halacha, Jewish law. It was there that Moshe Kotavira wrote his famous works on Kabbalah, such as Pardes Rimonim and Sefer Alima. And it was there that the Arizal shared his Kabbalistic insights with Reb Chaim Vital, who, in turn, wrote them down in the Sefer Eitz Chaim. This all came about through the confluence of two seemingly unrelated events. First, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in the year 1492, and second, the conquest by the Ottoman Turks of much of the entire Middle East and the Balkan states, thus creating what was known as the Ottoman Empire. These Turks not only took in the desperate and impoverished refugees of the Iberian Peninsula, but enabled them to thrive, thus ushering in an almost unprecedented age of wealth, scholarship, and literary creativity. The Gemara Megillah 13b of Gimel Amud Beis explains that whenever Hashem wishes to punish the Jews, Bora Lohem Rafua Tchila, He carefully constructs the antidote, the medicine before Him. In this case, it would seem that the Rafua for the Spanish expulsion was the creation of the Ottoman Empire. Let us first begin with a short history of the early days of that empire and how that empire served as a safe haven for Jews across the world in general and Sephardic Jewry in particular, creating a fertile soil for the renaissance of a Jewish community that experienced a sharp decline over the centuries. Now, in the first half of the 13th century, a small band of Muslim Turks were forced from their home in Iran by the Mongol hordes and moved westward into Asia Minor. Under the leadership of their leader, Ertogrul, they entered the service of Allah ad-Din, the Sultan of Iconium, the last remnant of the great empire that the Seljuk Turks had once created in Western Asia, and were granted some land in Phrygia, Central Anatolia, or which is like Asia Minor. This is part of Turkey, Western Turkey. Othman, his son, and the namesake of the Ottoman Empire, became the leader of his tribe at his father's death in 1288 and expanded their original holdings through numerous conquests throughout Asia Minor. After Othman's death in 1326, his son, Orhan, carried on the aggressive policies of his father and established his capital in Bursa, northeastern Anatolia, the ancient capital of Bithynia. If you know Roman history, Bithynia had a place. After having first defeated the armies of the crumbling Byzantine Empire and wresting the area from them. By the way, Bursa was the first Jewish community to come under protection of the Ottoman Turks. In accordance with the peace treaty, the Greek Orthodox Christians, or Byzantines, of Bursa were removed. Consequently, the Jews, who had been terribly mistreated by the Byzantines, were now granted freedom by the new conquerors, and a special firman, a royal order, was decreed, allowing the Jews to build a new synagogue, which they called Eitz Chaim. They were also allowed to engage in business throughout the country without hindrance and to purchase homes and land in the towns and villages. All of this was forbidden to them under the Byzantines. In addition to Bursa, Orhan also captured Gallipoli, which from the very early times had a Jewish community. And if you're familiar, in 1915, under the auspices of Winston Churchill, who was a undersecretary there, and under the British Empire, there was an abortive attempt by the British. It was a massive movement of troops. This is in the Gallipoli Peninsula, and it ended up in terrible defeat. But it was there that this was the first time that there was a Jewish quasi-army, the Zion Mule Corps. These Jews were not allowed to fight, but were allowed to carry as a group, to carry provisions for the British, and they acted very heroically. Jabotinsky was very involved in not only the creation, but in the involvement of the Zion Mule Corps. But this is Gallipoli. Orhan's son and successor, Murad I, who ruled between 1360 and 1389, expanded the empire even further by capturing Adrianople in Southeast Europe in 1361 and making it his capital. Adrianople at one time had a very famous Jewish community. He also greatly expanded his holdings in Turkey and captured Ankara, which is today the capital of the modern state of Turkey. Both Ankara and Adrianople already had functioning Jewish communities. By the way, in 1389, Sultan Murad broke the power of the Kingdom of Serbia in what was known as the First Battle of Kosovo. I don't know if you remember. It's not ancient history, but it's history that happened a few decades ago. The Sultan lost his life in that battle, but his son and successor, Bayezid I, continued to fight and defeated the Serbs. Much of the political struggle in the Balkans, which we witnessed less than a few decades ago between the Muslims of Kosovo and Bosnia and the Orthodox Christians of Serbia, traces its origins to that battle. Bayezid went on to expand his holdings and conquer the cities of Sofia, Nicopolis, and Vidin in what is today Bulgaria. So you see, it's really the empire started expanding. On one hand, it was conquering Turkey. On the other hand, it was spreading towards the Balkans. These towns also had indigenous Jewish communities. After Bayezid's defeat and capture in 1402 at the hand of Timur at Tamerlane, the head of the Mongols, and his subsequent death in captivity the next year, and I'm sure he was tortured. How bad is Bayezid that you can imagine what Tamerlane was? I mean, he was a struggle ensued amongst his sons, his son of his Bayezid. Finally, in the year 1413, his youngest son, Mehmed, or Muhammad I, became the undisputed head of the Ottoman Turks and continued the conquests, capturing Izmir, or Smyrna, which is on the coast of Turkey, a city destined to become a major Jewish center. His successor, Murad II, who ruled between 1421 and 1451, extended his dominion over Macedonia and parts of Greece, capturing Salonika and Ioannina. By the way, the Ishakas family here in this city traced their ancestry. The grandfather came from Ioannina. Salonika, at the time of the Ottoman conquest, already had an ancient Jewish community of Greek-speaking Jews known as Romaniot, as well as more recent refugees from Germany and Italy. After the death of Murad II, his son Mehmed or Muhammad II continued to expand the Ottoman Empire. Mehmed is best known, however, as the conqueror of Constantinople, the capital of the once great Byzantine Empire. Just as an aside, And I only read this in one source, so I haven't read it in other sources. It's an amazing thing how Constantinople was captured. There were many, many times the Turks tried to capture Constantinople. It was a walled city. It seems from my reading that one of those, the Byzantines, who was supposed to be guarding this, opened the door to do some scouting, left the city. It was an open door. The Turks found the open door, just opened it up, and they all poured in. And that's how Constantinople was. And it was conquered. It wasn't for the great generalship of... Yeah, there may be, but this really was captured because they found an open door. The moral of the story is, at night, keep your doors locked. The Greek-speaking Byzantines consider themselves to be the rightful heirs of the Roman Empire, as Constantinople had once been the capital of the entire Roman Empire, and later the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, and hence the Greek-speaking Jews of the former Eastern Roman Empire were called Romaniotes. Now, wherever the Turks conquered, the Jews were treated well. To appreciate the difference of how Jews were treated in the Ottoman Empire during this period, compared to how they were treated in Christian Europe, I would like to quote the following letter from a certain Yitzhak Tsarfassi, you know, Yitzhak of France, to the Jews of Europe during this period. Quote, "Brothers and teachers, friends and acquaintances, I, Yitzhak Tsarfati, though I spring from French stock," and that's how he got the name Tsarfati, "yet I was born in Germany and sat there at the feet of my esteemed teachers. I proclaim to you that Turkey is a land wherein nothing is lacking and where, if you will, all shall yet be well with you. The way to the Holy Land is open to you through Turkey." When he wrote this, of course, Turkey was held by the Ottomans, and Eretz Yisrael was held by the Mamluks. However, it's still possible to emigrate from Turkey to the Mamluk-headed, you know, held Eretz Yisrael. And he continues, "It is not better for you to live under Muslims than under Christians. Here every man may dwell at peace under his own vine and fig tree," which is a biblical phrase. "Here you are allowed to wear the most precious garments. In Christendom, on the contrary, you dare not even venture to clothe your children in red or in blue, according to your taste, without exposing them to the insult of being beaten black and blue, or kicked green and red and green. And therefore are you condemned to go about plainly clad in sad colored clothing." It's interesting from his viewpoint, but it's just, you know, how he describes the conditions. "All your days are full of sorrow, even the Sabbaths and the times appointed for feasting. Strangers enjoy your goods, and therefore of what profit is the wealth of your rich men? They hoard it, but to their own sorrow, and in a day it is lost to them forever. You call your riches your own. Alas, they belong to them. They bring false accusations against you. They respect neither the age nor wisdom. And though they gave you a pledge sealed 60-fold, yet they would break it. They continue to lay double punishment upon you, a death of torment and confiscation of goods. They prohibit teaching in your schools. They break in upon you during your hours of prayer. And they forbid you to work or conduct your business on Christian feast days." And he continues on, "And now, seeing all these things, O Israel, wherefore sleepeth thou? Arise and leave this accursed land forever." End quote. Now, Mehmed II's positive attitude towards the Jews was certainly enhanced by his employment of a Jew as his personal physician. And for hundreds of years afterwards, the sultans were served by Jewish physicians who enjoyed tremendous influence in the royal court. Now, at the time of the conquest of Constantinople, the city, which is known today as Istanbul, the chief rabbi of its small community was Harav HaGaon Rav Moshe Kapsali, originally from Crete, who studied under some of the leading rabbinic authorities of his time. Rav Yaakov Landau, the author of the Sefer Ogur, and Rav Yehuda Mintz of Padua. Rav Moshe was 25 when he took the position as Rav of Constantinople, and was 33 at the time of the Ottoman conquest in the year 1453. It seems that Rav Moshe found favor in the eyes of Sultan Mehmed II, as he appointed Rav Moshe to the position as chief rabbi of the entire Ottoman Empire. Now, Murat treated all of the Dehimis, the non-Muslim second-class citizens of his empire, with great respect, granting them complete religious freedom. But this was particularly the case with the Jews, whom he invited to leave their present homes, wherever they lived, and settle within his empire. In other words, he had an invitation, Jews throughout the world, you're invited to come to move to Turkey. Especially in the area adjacent to Constantinople on the eastern bank of the Golden Horn River, where land was generously given to them, hence ushering an era of material and eventually spiritual and intellectual success for the Jews. It was a mutually beneficial relationship, however, as the taxes the Jews paid served as an important source of income for the Sultan. And, as the chief rabbi, was responsible for Moshe Kapsali to oversee the collection of these taxes. It was also his responsibility to oversee the appointment of Rabbonim and Dayanim, rabbinic judges, throughout the empire. One thing that Moshe Kapsali could not do, however, was to help, at least in an official capacity, the collection of money for the Aniyim, the poor of Eretz Yisrael. As Eretz Yisrael at that time was under the rule of the Mamluks, who were engaged in ongoing war against the Ottomans. So therefore they could not move money officially through official channels directly from the Ottoman Constantinople to Mamluk, Yerushalayim. In a previous lecture given some years ago, which was devoted to the history of the Ottoman Empire, we explained how a German Jew who came to collect for Eretz Yisrael was terribly frustrated and angry at Rav Moshe Kapsali's refusal to help him raise funds. And as a result, this person, together with Rav Moshe Kapsali's enemies, waged a smear campaign against him, attempting to besmirch his name and his qualifications as a scholar. In the end, though, Rav Moshe was vindicated, with many of the leading scholars of the time coming to his defense. Now, after the death of Mehmed, says, or Muhammad II, the conqueror of Constantinople in the year 1481, his son Bayezid II became sultan. Now, as the Ottoman Empire was expanding its boundaries and threatening the empire of the Mamluks, another event occurred that eventually changed the history of the Ottoman Empire in general and Eretz Yisrael in particular. That is the expulsion of the Jews of Spain in the year 1492. In previous lectures, we spoke at length about the history of Spanish Jewry and the events that led up to the expulsion and the expulsion itself. As we said before, Hashem creates a punishment, he carefully constructs the antidote, the medicine beforehand. In the case of the Spanish expulsion, it would seem that the refuah, the antidote, was the creation of the Ottoman Empire, which served as a gracious host to those poor immigrants through the influence of his chief rabbi, Rav Moshe Kapsali, and the Sultan's chief, and the Sultan's Jewish physician, who prevailed upon the Sultan to take in the many unfortunate Jews who, with great effort, were able to reach the Ottoman Empire. In other words, through their influence that it created, through the chief rabbi's influence and the chief physician's influence, that they were able to to create an atmosphere, an environment that would be welcoming to the Jews. Furthermore, Rav Moshe organized rescue efforts on behalf of these Jewish exiles, many of whom had been captured and were about to be sold into slavery. According to the description of Eliyahu Kapsali, Rav Moshe's great nephew, quote, "The communities of Turkey performed innumerable and unlimited great deeds of charity, giving money as if it were stones to redeem captives and restore Jews to their environment," end quote. In addition, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi one of the leading Torah scholars of his generation, who eventually succeeded Rav Moshe Kapsali as chief rabbi in the year 1496, devoted himself totally to the rescue efforts. This is how Rav Eliyahu Mizrachi himself, in a tshuva, a response, and described his rescue efforts on behalf of the fleeing Sephardic Jews. Quote, "All of those who were expelled from Spain received honor from me in accordance with my ability, and I performed many services for them as they themselves attest. For almost a year I toiled on their behalf to collect funds, many hundreds of florins, to free those that were taken captive. I became embroiled in a terrible controversy with all of the various Jewish communities as I gathered on behalf of the Jewish exile, on three or four occasions, close to 3,000 florins." And evidently they were averse to the fact that so much money was leaving their community. "In the process, I excommunicated many wealthy members of the community because they refused to contribute the amount that I had asked of them. I also used a considerable amount of my own resources, as God is my witness. I even put my own life in danger due to the immense and constant strain and aggravation I went through day and night. This is in addition to the sacrifice of almost a year of lost study and research." End quote. This is from the tshuva. This is one of the tshuvas, or the tshuvas El Yom Mizrachi, number Samach Vav 66. Bayezid II, who was well disposed to the Jews, is quoted as if saying, in reference to King Ferdinand of Aragon, who together with his wife Queen Isabella of Castile was responsible for the expulsion of the Jews, quote, "You are mistaken to call the king wise, for he only ruined his own country by expelling the Jews and enriched our own," end quote. Now, Bayezid was not exaggerating, as these immigrant Sephardic Jews soon became the leading Jewish scholars and business people throughout the Ottoman Empire, joining the already increasing number of Jews, Ashkenazim and Romaniot, who were filling the empire. Salonika in Greece under Ottoman rule now grew into a major Torah center with many yeshivas and Torah scholars. Constantinople or Istanbul, the capital of the empire, soon boasts of having 50,000 Jewish residents with 44 different shuls. Synagogues represent the diverse backgrounds of the many Jews who lived in the Turkish capital. You can imagine how many shtiblach there were. And Sfas, once a backwater under the Mamluks, became one of the leading Torah centers of the world after its conquest by the Ottomans. I would first like to describe Sfas Safed as it was under the Mamluks. This first account of Safed in paragraph A on the first page is taken from the second letter sent by Rav Avadia Bartanura in the year 1489. In the previous lecture, we quoted from that letter as it pertained to Yerushalayim. This is a letter to Rav Avadia Bartanura's brother, and it seems to be a response to a letter that he received from his brother. And he was asking about the miracles, at least the reports of miracles that had occurred. People went to the grave sites of the great tzaddikim. And he writes, Rav Avadia Bartanura, "I did some research in the reports of miracles that appeared on the Temple Mount and through the prayers by the graves of the Hasidim." Why do you take such an interest in such things, my brother? Evidently he was a real misnagat. And it continues on the 28th of Iyar, and perhaps it's the 18th of Iyar, but this is the text reads the 28th of Iyar, is the anniversary of his, and then he does not state who, an unnamed tzaddik, but quite possibly referring to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Is the anniversary of his death, his yahrzeit. They come from all around and light large torches, and in addition to the Ner Tomid, the perpetual lamp. The Arabs have tremendous respect for this place and are afraid to come close to any place that has been sanctified to his name, Hashem's name. This place used to have silver vessels and many beautifully embroidered and gilded covers. However, it, together with all the other public items and property, had already been sold by the evil elders of Jerusalem. This we discussed in the last lecture. They had they needed, the community of Jerusalem needed tremendous amounts of money to rebuild a synagogue that had been destroyed by the Arabs. And they, that and the loans that they had taken on interest was a tremendous burden. And the funds that were coming from outside of Eretz Yisrael seemed not to at all have filled their needs. And as a result, there were some 300 Sifrei Torah that they had that they sold, and all of the ornaments they sold, and it seems that they sold even that which was in the Galilee, not just in Yerushalayim. And it continues on, they haven't even left any remnant of all of this splendor. Now, I haven't seen or heard about any open miracles associated with that place, except for the reports that many barren women became pregnant and the sick were healed through the donations that they made to enhance that place. I haven't had the time to go to that place or travel anywhere since coming through Yerushalayim. Consequently, with the exception of hearsay, I really can't give you any information about the Galilee or any other area. From what I hear about Sfas, the Sabbath, or Kfar Kina, or the other areas of the Galilee, they live a peaceful and tranquil life without disturbances from the Arabs. However, most of them are poor, living in outlying villages and eke out a living as peddlers, going from house to house with their wares in the courtyards and fields. According to the reports, however, in Damascus, the Jews are engaged in business and are wealthy. There's no place on earth like Damascus that is filled with Hashem's blessings, with houses, gardens, and orchards. The air, however, is not pure, and any stranger who comes there immediately becomes sick. The next, more detailed account of the state of Safed, Sfas, under the Mamluk rulers of Egypt, is taken from the letter which we quoted in the last lecture, which was written in 1495 by an anonymous disciple of Rav Avadya Bar Tanura. Again, we quoted only in that lecture as it related to Rav Avadya Bar Tanura. And he starts off, Damascus is a great city in God's eyes. Its streets are wide and possess beautiful houses and courtyards and plentiful springs. There are three Jewish communities in Damascus, for the area is large and spread out. Between all of them, there are 500 householders. Some of them are merchants who deal in clothing and all items. Some of them are craftsmen. Others make their living from lending money on secure pledges for a fee of 24 Venetian gold pieces for every 100 which is lent. Others place their money on, I don't know what this is referring to, Hakitimu, and make a profit of not less than 18 for every 100 invested. In short, it is quite easy to make a living in Damascus according to what I have heard. In this regard, I can only repeat what I have heard, for on Rosh Hashanah I became afflicted with sanverim, an eye disease, and remained secluded in the house in which I was staying up until the time we had to leave Damascus. This was caused by the extreme cold I had to endure on the road at night, as I stated previously. And it continues on, Safed is built on the slope of a mountain. It is a large city, but the houses are small and pitiful. When the rain falls, it is impossible to walk in the city because of the filth. And because it is built on a slope, and one has to always climb up or down, it is very difficult and exhausting to go out to the marketplace and streets, even in the summer. Nevertheless, the land is very good and healthful, and water is extremely good. Now, the truth is that I saw there many elderly people who were more than 60 or 70 years old, and one particular older gentleman, a man who still possessed youthful vigor and was quite healthy despite the fact that he was 130 years old. The Holy Jewish community consists of approximately 300 householders. Most of the Jews have stores of either spices or cheese or oil or different types of legumes or fruits. It's interesting. He spoke, you know, before about the people being peddlers. Maybe it's in the outlying areas. I heard that 25 ducats, the yearly profits of one of these stores, is enough to support five people. Food there is also inexpensive. The Gaon Rabbeinu Peretz Kolobo, may he see descendants in a long life as the head and leader of the city. He was very kind to us and sung our praises to others. After he came, the writer of this letter was a young man. He also offered, if we decide to stay there, to house us, take care of our material needs, and to learn with us for the sum of 12 ducats a year per student. You know, the problems of tuition are not new. The community gives him a stipend to take care of his minimal needs. I forgot the sum. Nevertheless, he also maintains a food store to add to his basic food needs. Surrounding Safed Sfas, there are many catacombs in which the great Hasidim are buried. Many of them are within 6 mil of the city, and I personally saw some of them. Okay, again, this was written in the year 1495 by this Italian disciple of Rav Avadya. He eventually made his way to Yerushalayim, and he became a Talmud, a disciple of Rav Avadya Bartanura. But notice again, in both letters, the difference between the situation of the Jewish community of Damascus and that of Tzfas. Now, after years of prolonged warfare, Sultan Salim I, the son of Bayezid II, who had inherited the throne from his father in the year 1512, finally defeated the Mamluks in the years 1516 and 1517, thus crowning himself as the titular ruler, the caliph of the entire Muslim world. To an empire that had only included Turkey and the Balkan states, Salim now added Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, the Arabian Peninsula, Eretz Yisrael, Syria, and Iran. Suleiman, who inherited his father's throne in the year 1520, expanded the empire further to include Hungary, Iraq, and Albania, and established Ottoman naval supremacy in the Mediterranean. He even laid siege to Vienna, which he failed to conquer. In addition, Suleiman beautified the city of Yerushalayim, retiling the Dome of the Rock with some 450,000 new tiles, and rebuilt the walls surrounding Yerushalayim, the same walls that you see today surrounding the old city. So those walls are from Suleiman. During his reign, the population of Yerushalayim also increased. The general population tripled to 16,000, and the Jewish population doubled to some 2,000. Economically, however, even under Ottoman reign, the Jewish population of Jerusalem was still very poor and felt the brutal burden of taxation, as we now read here on page 3. This is taken from the Tshuva from Maral Bach, Rav Levi Ibn Habib, who in the mid 1500s was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Not only is the food of the residents of Yerushalayim not sumptuous, but it comes through bitterness and grief. Anyone who earns enough to buy the head of a goat and its innards for Shabbos or Yom Tov considers himself as fortunate, just as fortunate as if he were released from the house of bondage, became a free man, now sits amongst the nobility. There's such a simcha that he has for Shabbos the head of a goat. And it's inner, it's kitschkes. Yeah, this was written in the year 1538, over 20 years after Salim had conquered Yerushalayim from the Mamluks. The place where growth was most felt, however, was Tzfas or Safed, which during the reign of Suleiman became a major agricultural and commercial center. The following is the account of one traveler to Tzfas, David del Rossi. This is how we describe the situation in the year 1535. This is on page 3, paragraph B. He who saw Safed 10 years ago and observes it now has the impression of a miracle. For more Jews are arriving here continually, and the tailoring trade grows daily. I have been told that more than 15,000 suits have been manufactured in Safed during this year, besides fancy suits. Every man and every woman who works wool and fabric earns an abundant living. Hatred of the Jews is, in contrast to our homeland, unknown here, and the Turks hold the Jews in esteem. In this country and in Egypt, Jews are the chief officers and administrators of the customs. No injuries are perpetrated against them in the whole empire. Only this year, in consequence of the extraordinary expenditure caused by the war against Persia, the Suleiman went to war against Iran, were the Jews asked to make advances of loans to the princes. All articles of commerce are available in these countries. Fibers spun and unspun are exported from Safed in great quantities, also oil, honey, and small quantities of silk. From other countries, we get all kinds of spices such as pepper, muscat nuts, ginger, and cane spices. Many people, among them also Jews, buy these goods for selling. Some merchants trade with the Jews for exchange in amounts of over 10,000 in each transaction. My dear wife Sora, since she has come to Safed, has recovered, this is with the help of God, for the water and the air are unusually good. Only few illnesses occur here, and therefore the medical art does not flourish, and the physicians do not earn much money. Sick people eat big or small cucumbers, gourds, and many kinds of fruits. Not only did Tzfas experience extraordinary economic growth, but also growth as a Torah center. As we read the following tshuvas from the leading Torah authorities of Tzfas. This is on page 4. The first response is written by Rav Yosef Karo. Actually, this is the first of the tshuvas in his collection. This is Afkis Rocha. Hear, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and you strong foundations of the earth, the zeal of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard and a very fruitful hill. For when God saw the suffering of his people Israel, which has lasted some 1,500 years, in which they were banished from their land and exiled from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another, and experienced so many exiles and forced conversions, he, Hashem, remembered the covenant of their forefathers and caused their captivity to return and gather them from the ends of the earth. They came, one survivor from a city and two from a clan, to the land of desire, Eretz Yisrael, and they settled in the city of Safed Tzfas, the most sought-after place in the world. At that time, their leaders acted properly to relieve the tax burden of the poor and destitute and the students of Torah as well, and they would free them from paying the poll tax. If someone had a limited ability to pay, they would take something from him, from some a half and from others a quarter of their taxes. From Torah scholars, they would not generally take anything, with the exception of someone of limited capital from whom they would take half of their tax payment. This practice applies solely to poll tax. Regarding the other taxes and levies, it was inconceivable for the community to ask payment for anyone for whom the Torah was their chief livelihood and only worked on the side. The honor and awe of the Torah was constantly uppermost in the minds of the leaders of the community. They wouldn't do anything without consulting the sages, the elder rabbis. Everything was done according to the guidelines which they set. In this manner, God's vineyard, the house of Israel, was beautifully tended and pleasant. The vines blossomed, and the pomegranates budded. The Rosh Yeshivas and their students studied in their places without disturbance. They didn't hear the sound of oppressor. The vineyard was walled in and the stones were removed by the philanthropic members of the nation of the God of Abraham who lived in the diaspora, who provided them with food. After the second letter now, we'll put this in context. But he was basically saying, for all of these years, really the Torah community of Tzfas was supported generously by Jews from from the diaspora, and their taxes were paid for. The next tshuva response and letter is from Rav Moshe ben Yosef Trani, the Mabit, who was equally a senior rabbi in Sfas. Also, the origin came from Spain. I mean, they passed from Spain, they went to Italy, and the family went from Italy, and they came to Sfas. That's where it's Trani, which is an Italian city. There were two Sephardic shuls, communities, and Yosef Karo was the Rav of one, and Rav Moshe ben Yosef Trani was the Rav of the other. So they were, and Svas. So they were both the leading Rabbonim. In a previous lecture some years ago, we went through the Smicha controversy, where Rav Yaakov Beirav was the leading at the time in the year 1538, the leading Rav Talmud Chacham in Sfas, gave Smicha to four great scholars. There's a controversy about two of them. The two are well known and well accepted. One was of Yosef Karo, received the ordination. The other was Moshe ben Yosef Trani. These were the two great minds, great scholars and saints of that period living in Sfas. Now what we're going to read is a tshuva responsum from the Mabit, from Moshe ben Yosef Trani. The reason that none of the Torah scholars have paid taxes up until now is because their chief occupation day and night is the study of Torah. They leave their homes only for a short period during the day in order to oversee that their work, which others are doing on their behalf, is being faithfully executed and to provide for their food and their other needs. Afterwards, without wasting any time on trivial pursuits, they immediately return to their true profession, which is the study of Torah. The non-learning time that they spend is strictly enough to provide for their needs so that they need not be supported by the community, not to become wealthy. Those wealthy scholars originally came from the outside of Eretz Yisrael, only acquired their wealth over there. This is because it was customary for men of means to provide scholars with merchandise so they could easily resell it and make a profit. It is therefore fitting that the leaders of the city, because they not alter the boundaries that were fixed by early stages, does not make any changes. And those that came after them, who expounded upon the scripture, which are the source of the exemption of Torah scholars from all forms of taxation. And it continues on, such a thing was not done in a more than 40 years since the surge of immigration to Eretz Yisrael.
One thing
about taking taxes from Torah scholars.
They did not take taxes
from Torah scholars.
For 40
years. Yeah, and this is the period since the great influx of immigrants, which really came after it came not immediately after the expulsion, but really after the Ottomans took over that area and made it welcome for Jews, because under the Mamluks it was very difficult. Now, these tshuvas were written in a response to a movement within Sfas, Safed, that the Torah scholars not be relieved from the burden of taxation. And there was a moving afoot by Balabas. And that is basically, there's so much money that has to be paid for the taxes. If you have these exemptions, then the other people have to pay them. And that was really, there was a movement amongst non-Torah scholars that they don't want to shoulder the burden, and that's why these two tshuvas were written, that there not be a change in the status quo. Now, the following is another tshuva from Moshe Trani, the Mabit, which paints an intimate picture of life in Sfas during this period. Here, and it's on page 5. Since the days of my youth, from the year 5281, 1521. I took a leadership role in Sfas and all matters dealing with the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. From then on until the present, this eve of Rosh Hashanah, and this is 5335, and there's 1574, I have expounded on the questions that were posed to me and made myself available to respond to all that the Sephardic Jews who came here to Safed requested of me. God has inspired me to rebuild the ruins of Safed, and I supervise the great building activity so that no one encroaches upon the boundaries of another. I adjudicate all of the distribution of land, as well as issues of invasion of privacy and blocking of light that come about through building on adjacent lots. During all of these years, as the different communities and their distinctive native tongues separated and built synagogues, were involved in enacting ordinances for all of the communities. These ordinances mandated all new immigrants who originate from the Turkish Empire, as well as from other countries, to attach themselves solely to the synagogue of their respective communities. This was done in order to facilitate support for the poor of that distinctive community. In other words, let's say a person of wealth from the Romaniote. And he would be part of a synagogue of Romaniote, then the people are poor. So he would, in a sense, would have a greater burden to help with the poor. However, if he would go into another shul, another synagogue, which is full of wealthy people, then the burden placement is less. So they made it, you have to stay within your community. Because the Sephardim, the exiles of Spain, formed the majority of the Safed community, they needed two synagogues. One is called Kahal Godel, and the other is called Kahal Yaakov. Originally, there was a unified, and the Beis Yosef, I think, was the Rav of the first, and the Mabit was the Rav of the second, I believe. Originally, there was a unified collection and distribution system for both synagogues for charities, taxes, and levies, as they were actually one distinct linguistic group. Afterwards, because of differences of opinion, the two synagogues separated and supervised their own collections and distributions for the poor of their respective communities and for everything else. You know, you could have predicted this. We instituted that any Sephardic Jew that moves to Safed can freely join the synagogue of his choice, no synagogue infringe upon the other. And it continues on, every year we jointly sign a letter addressed to all of the holy congregation of the city to help support the indigent of our communities. Because of this, money comes in every year for all of the poor. This also spurs the wealthy to come and give special donations, a commemoration of the pilgrims who came every a holiday with donations. So Yom Tovim, the people tend to become more generous. The following tshuva from the Mabit gives us a further glimpse into the life of that period and the power of the rabbinate to rectify the shortcomings of the community. Here on page 6, in years past we gathered together in the meeting hall to oversee the breaches of the city and to mend the fences of God's vineyard. Including in the rulings that we issued was the reinstatement of forgotten commandments, such as the special gifts for the Kohanim, the Zroya, Lechayim, and Keva, the four-legged cheeks and maw, which are directed today at the Jewish butchers to own the animals. And as they should, the butchers really slaughtered the animals or oversaw the slaughter, and it was theirs, and they should be the ones to give it to Kohanim. Evidently, in that time, there were Kohanim Yuchosim, the people, the Kohanim, that they were understood to be the pure descendant. The halacha was fixed for all generations, and it continues. This practice continued for many years until the period of political upheaval and economic distress in which the ordinance was abandoned. Afterwards, we were not able to rectify the situation, and the priestly entitlements, matnas kahuna, were stolen from them by the butchers. It continues on, in order to facilitate the restoration of practice of matnas kahuna, the gifts to the priest, as mandated by the Torah, I see it befitting to decree upon the butchers they do not sell the foreleg, and to inform their own household is forbidden to eat. In other words, the butchers can't take it for themselves either. They have to distribute to the kahanim. If they do sell it, they're required to tell their customers that they are required to give it to the kahanim. And if they sell it now, the customer has it in his rishus, in his domain, and the customer now has to go and to give it to the kohen. Afterwards, the customers can claim a refund from the butcher. I hope that through these prohibitions that will come, they will come to give the matnas kuna to the kahanim, who have no power to force them. Evidently, the problem of rabbonim and butchers is a very old one. And again, Rav Moshe, Rav Yosef signed an addition, Rav David ben Ibn Zimra. Rav David ben Zimra was formerly the chief rabbi of Egypt. In his old age, he emigrated in Eretz Yisrael and settled in Stas. The two great halachic authorities of that period were Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe Trani, the Mabit. As is frequently the case with people of high intelligence and integrity, they did not always agree on every issue. One case in point is regarding Shemitah, the laws of the seventh year in Eretz Yisrael, as applies to the separation of the gifts of the Kohen and Maestro's tithes on produce from non-Jewish lands. The following is taken from a tshuva from the Mabit, and this is how a later sage, Rav Yomtov of Tzalon, Maritat, described Tzfas during this period. So first we're going to quote from the Mabit. For the last 28 years from the year 5292, 1532, into the year 5321, 1560, four Shemitahs in all, I have been involved in the halakhic issues of produce growing on non-Jewish land in Eretz Yisrael, regarding the laws of Shemitah, the requirements of taking truma and maestros, the tithes, if that grain was processed as a nismarcho by a Jew. In other words, the land was owned by non-Jews. Generally, the Jews bought a finished product. Sometimes, though, they would buy the grain and process the grain. I have already written my opinion the grain is free from the requirement of tithing. And if you buy it on the Shemitah year, and it's from non-Jewish held land, it says it is free from tithing. He generally maintained that if you buy produce from non-Jewish land, you have to tithe. In other words, their ownership does not take away from the Kedusha, the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, and has to be tied. However, his argument was on the Shemitah year, it is automatically Hefker, whether it belongs to a Jew or a non-Jew. And things which are Hefker means non-owned, they're publicly owned already, the laws of tithing do not apply. And now in the Shemitah, I have seen that the Chacham Reb Yosef, this is from Yosef Karma, Hashem help him, issued a ruling to separate Trumas and Maestros. He argued on this. He says, when you buy it in the Shemitah year, you have to separate Trumas and Maestros. And the reason is, according to Yosef Karo, that the Shemitah, that we say that things are hefker, that are unowned, and anyone can take it, is, according to Yosef Karo, is not automatic. It is a requirement from the owner to make it hefker. Now, if it is owned by non-Jews, they are not making it hefker. And they are not bound by halacha. And therefore, it is not hefker. Well, if it's not hefker, then it's regular produce, and tithes have to be taken. That's really the argument between them. But it, and then later, in the children of Yom Tov Tzalon, says, I remember that when I was young, the city of our God was filled with all manner of praise, wealth, and honor. And the great elderly holy rabbis of Yosef Karo, Rav Yisrael Kuriel, and Rav Moshe Trani, their portion is now bound in eternal life. This was the golden age. Through the years, Turkey became a haven not only for the original Spanish exiles, but also for the Bali Tshuva, a nuisance forced converts or conversos, or their descendants who joined their fellow Jews and returned back to Judaism. Two of the most outstanding of these conversos who left Europe and migrated to Turkey were Donna Gracia, or Hanna Mendes, the head of the House of Mendes, at one time one of the most powerful banking houses in all of Europe, and her nephew and soon-to-be son-in-law, Yoeyo Miguez, who was later known as Don Yosef Nossi. In the previous lecture, we discussed at length the story of their escape from the vice of the Inquisition. In the year 1553, Donna Gracia and her entire entourage arrived in Constantinople and openly embraced Judaism. The next year, Yosef, her nephew, joined them and married her, Donna Gracia's daughter, Reina. Yosef, with his vast knowledge of Europe, its politics and economics, quickly rose in the court of Sultan Suleiman to become the most powerful man in all of Turkey. Upon their arrival in Constantinople, the Jewish community immediately felt their gracious hand. The Nossi family supported the poor, established synagogues and yeshivas. With the death of Suleiman in the year 1566, his son Selim II became the Sultan. Soon afterwards, he elevated Yosef Nossi and made him duke over the island of Naxos in the Aegean Sea. He was known as the Duke of Naxos. He also gave him the adjacent islands of the Cyclades island chain, Andraparo, Antiparo, Milo, 12 islands in all, which Selim had only recently wrested from the Venetians, thereby granting him the title of Count of Andros. In addition, Don Yosef received the city of Tiberia, under his jurisdiction. He planned that Tiberia would become a haven for exiles from Christian lands like himself. At that time, Tiberia was completely desolate. The following is a contemporaneous account of Yosef HaKohen and his work Emek HaBocha of the attempt to settle Tiberias. And here is on page 7. Don Yosef Nossi, and there's a lot of ellipses here, found favor in the eyes of Suleiman the king, who granted him the ruins of Tiberias with 7 surrounding towns to be its nobleman and master. Just as an aside, it says, although Rav Yosef HaKohen claims that Suleiman gave Tiberias to Yosef Nossi, historians claim it was actually Suleiman's successor, Selim. And it continues on, Don Yosef sent Rav Yosef ben Ardit to build the walls of the city. Continues, he gave him documents sealed by the royal seal and gave him orders to tell the Pasha, governor in Damascus and Safed, the following, quote, whatever this man asks for, grant it to him. In other words, the governor was given such orders. The royal order went out directing the skilled and unskilled laborers to come to Tiberias to rebuild it. And it continues on, at that time an elderly Arab Sharif chieftain stood up and cried to the local natives, quote, don't let them build that city, for I have found in an ancient work, it continues, that when the city will be rebuilt, our religion will be destroyed, end quote. They refused to build the walls. Hearing this, the Pasha became incensed and immediately sent out troops to restore control. And it continues on, the workers then resumed digging the foundations for the wall. And the wall was finally completed in the month of Kislev, in November, December, in the year 5325, it was 1564. And it continues on, Don Yosef ordered mulberry trees to be planted there in order to provide food for silkworms. He also ordered wool to be imported from Spain so they could make clothing similar to that manufactured in Venice. Unfortunately, this attempt at resettling Tiberia was not successful, and eventually, after Yosef Nossi's lifetime, the city was abandoned. Don Yosef's influence lasted until the death of Selim II in 1574, and and the succession of his son, Murad III. He then retired to private life and devoted the rest of his life up until his death in the year 1579 to the support of scholars and the Torah. With his death began a period of steady decline within the Turkish Empire, both politically and spiritually. It was due to a number of factors, but first and foremost because of the weakness of the sultans and the central government that followed Murad III. The government was plagued by corrupt and rival political parties that fought for power, manipulated the sultans, and used the government for their own benefit. For the next 3+ centuries, the Turkish government suffered from corruption, nepotism, inefficiency, and misrule. The central government in Constantinople lost much of its hold on the local rulers, and as a result, security for the Jews declined and local taxation increased. Turkish orders had been found which demanded that the remaining wealthy Jews of Safed be expelled to Cyprus. Historians are not sure if it was ever carried out. The once self-sustaining city of Tsifas, Safed fell on hard times as Portugal and Holland grew in prestige, taking away markets once dominated by the Ottoman Turks. All this was coupled by a famine that began at the end of the 16th century. Because of the difficult straits in which the Jews found themselves, collections were organized throughout the world to help support the Jews of Safed. Rav Moshe Alshich, the great halachic authority and Talmud disciple of Yosef Karo, who received smicha, special ordination from him, if it is the smicha that I'm referring to, is not the regular rabbinic ordination. Rav Yaakov Beirav wanted to reinstitute the Sanhedrin. And this was really an ordination to become a member of the Sanhedrin. So Rav Alshich, who passed away in the year 1600, described the desperate situation in Safed, Tsfas, in the following manner here. This is on page 8. For 3 years, great judgments that enveloped the land. Continues on, one, a terrible famine, the likes of which has never occurred. Two, no one was able to earn any money. There was no buying or selling, no money changed hands, no work was available for the poor. The destitute sought work, but there was none to be had. And then the third was the worst of all, i.e. the burden of taxes from the king and corrupt officials. This one says, pay me the poll tax. And the other one says, give me the taxes due to the governor of Damascus, as well as for the governor of the land or for the vizier. That's the second to the king. From that time on, the land of the living became depleted. This one fled and forsook his father and mother. This one left his wife. That one his children. Another one his brothers. So all who have remained are in tears and cry out, quote, who knows if we'll ever see their faces again, end quote. And it continues on, from some 5,000 heads of households who formerly lived in Safed, Tsfas, there are now only some 400. A person who saw the city in its glory, the most beautiful of cities, the joy of the land, a great city full of scholars and teachers, would be shocked at the extent of its decline. And the following was written by Rav Shmuel de Ozida, who lived in Yerushalayim during this period. And he says, the verse, she has become a source of taxation, very lamash, can possibly be alluding to what we see in our own times. There is no area within the domains of our king, may his glory be exalted, that has more taxes and levies placed upon the Jews than Eretz Yisrael, and most especially Jerusalem. If not for the fact that Jews from all over the world send money to them to help pay their taxes and other levies, the Jewish community there would not be able to survive. As a result, communities outside of Eretz Yisrael redoubled their efforts to support those who had dedicated their lives to dwell within the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, as we now read from the proclamation made by the community of Venice, which was sent to the communities of Germany and Poland in the year 1600. Quote, we have heard of the dire straits in which our brethren in the land of Israel find themselves, Now there is added grief and distress as a ship containing many bundles of silver was captured. And it continues on, the ship also had much wool, which would have been a source of employment for the people there. From Constantinople, we heard the reports of how the famine has decimated their ranks and how the once prestigious yeshivas have scattered and left. And there's reports from Constantinople. The following is a proclamation. This is made by the community of Fez in the year 1603. This is on top of page 9. We received a letter which was signed by the most holy sage of the city of truth, Jerusalem, and our hearts melted. Every day the calamity has been greater and greater. The synagogue, which dates from the time of the Rambanzal, became the victim of misfortune as well known, and the holy forum are being held as a pledge. Because we see their plight, we the undersigned have agreed that all of the holy community should donate their money to redeem the holy people who continue to dwell before Hashem, the sages of Jerusalem. Continues on, every one of the members of the community of Fez, should remember Jerusalem through their generosity. In this period of misrule and corruption, the following misfortune occurred in Tzfas. This is from the Tshuva Marbit Shalom. Regarding the breaches in the wall of the city of our God, Tzfas, the enemies have made openings in the wall instead of being well protected like Jerusalem with its doors locked at night. Now, through our sins, it is an unwalled city. So besides of all of the difficulties, they're now at the mercy of bandits. It seems that by the end of the year 1602, there was somewhat an improvement of the situation, as the famine seems to have passed and the city of Tzfas began to become repopulated. As we now read from this very optimistic account written in the year 1607 by the Mekubal, a Kabbalist, Rav Shlomo Shlomiel, who had left his native Moravia in the year 1602 to settle in Tzfas. When he wrote this letter, of Moshe Galante, a leading Talmudic authority, a Mekubal Kabbalist, and a leading disciple of Rav Yosef Karo, and one of his Musmochim, ordained disciples, was still alive. In the letter of Shlomo, Shlomiel makes mention of two of the heads of the yeshivas of Tzfas, Rav Masod Saginor, who originally came from Fez, evidently he was blind, and was his Rebbe, his teacher, and Rav Shlomo Maravi. This is a sampling of what he wrote. I came to the holy lands of Tzfas, may it be rebuilt, in Upper Galilee on the intermediate days of Sukkot, 5263, 1602, in peace. I found there a holy community, a magnificent city before God, a city full of salvation with nearly 300 great rabbis, all pious and active men, with 18 yeshivas, 22 houses of prayer, and one big Beis HaMedrash, where about 400 children and young men are taught by 20 teachers without payment. For there are rich people in Constantinople provide the salaries of the teachers and have garments made for them every year. And it continues on, and the non-Jews who live on the soil of Israel, all of them bow before the holiness of Israel. And even when we remain standing in the field with talis and tefillin, for the whole day, nobody dares to step before the community of Israel while they are praying, but all walk about quietly and nobody makes any remark, thank God. It continues on, besides, I have found the entire Holy Land full of God's blessings, of great fullness and cheapness beyond imagination. When I saw the great fullness in the Holy Land and perceived how the nations of the world consume those goods while Israel is dispersed, and deprived of the right to enjoy the fruits of the land and to be satiated thereof, I broke out into tears and said, if the house of Israel knew only the tenth part of the fruits, goods, and fullness which are in the land of Israel, day and night would they lament their dispersal and the delightful land that they have lost, and which even its desolation brings forth fruits, fruit, wine, and silk for a third of the world. For ships anchor at its shores from all the corners of the world, from Venice, Spain, France, Portugal, Constantinople, and grain, olives, raisins, figs, sesame oil, wine, and liquor, produced from the juice of the palm tree. Palm trees are loaded into them. These must be dates. Must be made a liquor made out of dates. In addition, chicken, eggs, mutton and beef, fish, rice, and many kinds of beans, such as I've never seen and which taste like nuts, cucumber and vegetables can be obtained here during the whole year, in summer and winter, for nearly nothing. Moreover, good fruits like carobs, oranges, lemons, melons, and gourds, sweet as sugar. And he continues that then he can feed himself in the land of Israel for a third of the expense which he must waste in your country and live like a king, apart from the healthy and clean air and pure water, which prolong the life of man, so that some of the inhabitants reach an age of up to 80, 90, 100, even 110 years. So evidently the famine had stopped. But evidently it seems it was irreversible. The fact is, as being a manufacturing center, a major commercial center, and it was still a place for many, the Rabbonim, the Talmidim, they stayed and were supported by the gifts from outside of Eretz Yisrael. On the whole, however, despite the fact that there continue to be relatively large communities in Tzfas and Yerushalayim, with many visitors coming to pray at the Kvorim, the graves of the Tzaddikim, and others coming to make Eretz Yisrael their home, the glory days of Eretz Yisrael had already passed, with each year bringing its own set of challenges. During this period, the Jews of Eretz Yisrael were largely supported through the tzedakah, as we said before, the charity communities of Chutz Loritz, those living outside of Eretz Yisrael. In the year 1621, Rabbi Yeshaya Horvitz, the famed author of the Shnei Luchas HaBris, or Shalot, came to Eretz Yisrael. Although the Shalot had much hope through Yerushalayim, becoming once again a major center of Torah, hopes were soon dashed. I mean, the time doesn't allow you. You could read yourself from his letters and his great hope that things, that he moved to Yerushalayim, and he had hoped that his moving would be the beginning of a whole renaissance of Yerushalayim. And when he came, this is in 1621, things were relatively good. However, at the beginning of the year 1625, Chovov Tevis, only a few short years after he arrived, a certain local Arab, whose origin was actually from the Caucasus, the part which is today in Russia, Mahmud ibn Paruch, after having given a large bribe to the Turkish governor in Damascus, came back to Yerushalayim together with 300 armed men and ousted the then current governor of Yerushalayim. So there was a takeover. The current governor's name was Mahmud Pasha. And this fellow, Mahmud ibn Paruch, took his place. Ibn Paruch was a corrupt and hateful despot who made life increasingly difficult for Jerusalem's Jewish population. So at the time when the Shiloh, says Shai Horvitz, came originally to Rishon in 1621, things were relatively good. In the summer of the year 1625, Ibn Paruch left Jerusalem on a Hajj, a pilgrimage to Mecca. In his place, he left his brother-in-law, his wife's brother, Atman Aga, a man even more corrupt than he. This Atman Aga demanded the Jews give him 500 grush, an enormous sum for the already overtaxed community. The Jews sent a delegation to the governor of Damascus, Atman Aga's superior, pleading for reprieve from this terrible tax, and therefore delayed giving him the money. Growing impatient with their delaying tactics, on Shabbos the 11th of Elul, Atman Aga sent his police force into the synagogue and took by force 15 of Jerusalem's rabbis, including the Shalom, Yeshaya Horvitz, and had them cruelly imprisoned and threatened them with death. All the details of the story were printed 2 years later in Venice and in the world town as Chorvas Yerushalayim, destruction of Jerusalem. Atman Aga now demanded 20,000 grush, So before it just was 500 grush. Now it became 20,000 grush to have the rabbis released. After delegation, communal leaders fully explained to him that such a sum was simply impossible with their limited means. He reduced it to 11,000 grush. On Rosh Hashanah, the shalom was finally released. He immediately went into hiding in order to avoid being captured again. After some 4 months of hiding, the shalom successfully made his way out of Jerusalem together with his wife and his daughter and traveled to Tiberia. This is a city that was then in ruins. All of these events took their toll, and it seems that shalom passed away not long afterwards in Tiberia and was buried there right near the graves of the Rambam and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The high hopes that the Shiloh had for Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael never materialized. Despite the many great sages and saints that have occupied that city since the Shiloh's passing, Jerusalem, Yerushalayim did not become the preeminent center of Torah scholarship and piety that the Shiloh had envisioned. Only in the modern era, especially after the destruction of European Jewry during the Second World War, did Yerushalayim become once again the preeminent spiritual center of Jewry. In the next lecture, we continue on with the saga of the Yishuv, the resettlement of Eretz Yisrael prior to the modern era. Now, are there any questions? Yeah, you're asking about how they, in terms of how both the Mamluks and the Ottomans treated the Dahimis, the second-class cities, non-Muslims, with an indication that they were not as orthodox, as fervent. And the answer probably is yes, they were not as fervent. The Ottomans were Turks, they were not the Arabs, they were not as, you know, as fanatical. And as a result, during the time, if it had not been for their wanton thing of getting money and squeezing the Jewish community, but in terms of discrimination created by their religion, it doesn't seem to be, you know, it seems to have been relatively mild. Of course, there were other areas that were terrible for the Jews. But under the Mamluks and everything, it seems that was really not the religion itself was not the problem.
It was just a question of power and land.
And corruption and how much money you could squeeze out of people.
Rabbi Chaim and Zala, didn't
you
live
in the city? What? Who? Moshe Chaim and Zala. Moshe Chaim lived in Italy. And he moved towards the last year of his life. He moved to the circuit around there in 1747. We're not holding there yet. Well, get there.
The Jews of Damascus were mentioned in this.
Yeah, yeah.
Who controlled Damascus at the time?
So when this was written, in those two letters, it was controlled by the Mamluks. It was controlled by Egypt, really. So that was those two letters are written then. But later on, when the Ottomans captured Eretz Yisrael, they captured Damascus as well.
It seemed as though the Jews from Damascus were doing well.
Yeah, the Jews in Damascus were doing well.
The Mamluks left them alone.
Yeah, they left them alone, and it was doing well. Eretz Yisrael was just in a sense that we discussed, there was a curse. It wasn't, the Gula at the time didn't come yet. Agotavach.